For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Jesus, we ask that you open our eyes to the reality of what you're doing in the world today. Father, we see in a mirror dimly, and we have our picture of what's going on, and you see things really differently. So we ask you to give us your heart, and we particularly ask that for this moment in our culture in America, that you would give us a view in the mirror of what you're doing and what you're about to do so that we can cooperate with it. We ask for that in Jesus' powerful name. Amen. Okay, we call this All Quiet in the Western Church because I'm asking a question that's really critical to what this conference is about, which is the concept of why do we need to multiply? What's multiplication about? I'm going to try and give you information. It's totally okay with me if you don't buy it. I would encourage you to go check it out for yourself. But I'm basically going to suggest to you that we have a unique problem at this moment in history for us Americans. And that is this. Everywhere on planet Earth, the church is currently exploding beyond any other moment in the history of the church, except two places. You know where those are? Here and Western Europe. Western Europe and North America dominate the conference, book. We're the ones telling everybody how you're supposed to do this, and we're failing. The global church is exploding. My analogy, I'm from Kansas City, so my analogy, which Kansas Cityans will get better, is it would be the equivalent of the Kansas City Chiefs doing a DVD that they send to the Green Bay Packers on how to win the Super Bowl. It's like Packers are getting go like, what the heck? What? Why would we have any interest in this? So I'm going to try and give you some background. Again, Jim's here, and when he was speaking the other night, I was like, yeah, that's pretty much everything I'm saying there. But I'll wow you with statistics instead of content there. But basically, what we're finding is the best information we have, and again, if you think that we're wrong on this, go check it out. The American church is in significant decline. Now, most people kind of have a sense that maybe we're struggling a little bit, but you know what I will hear when I do this seminar in American churches? Oh, you're absolutely right, but not in my church. We're not struggling. We're not in decline. I think the American church is in decline, but we're not. We're figuring this out. At some point, again, that's the equivalent, using my Chiefs analogy, of Dwayne Bowe, our wide receiver, saying, I had a phenomenal gain. I gained 300 yards in this game, but the Chiefs lost 45 to nothing. The American church is in trouble right now. And we have to start owning that and playing team and saying, what's going on here and what do we do about it? And that's what I'm going to talk about. I kind of have an outline up there if you're having a hard time following what I'm saying there. But I want to start out talking about the problem of entropy. Entropy is a term used primarily in physics, which talks about why a bullet just doesn't keep traveling forever. Entropy is what causes that bullet to lose momentum and drop to the ground. Entropy is the normal nature of things, at least in a gravitational world. They begin to decline naturally. It's their natural bent is entropy. Bill Hybels, the pastor in Chicago, Willow Creek Community Church, defines leadership often as those who smell entropy before everyone else. And I found that to be a pretty practical description of how leadership often plays out. Oftentimes you have that sense of something's wrong before others have a sense that something's wrong. I don't know whether I'm a leader in that sense, but I have been smelling entropy in the American church for the last decade plus. So I'm going to share with you a couple of stories about why I got here, and then give you some sense of who I am, and then I'm going to try and give you the evidence as best I can for what's going on both in America and the global church. First whiff of entropy for me in 1985, I got a postgraduate fellowship, really cool kind. My wife and I had just been married. We didn't have kids left. They gave us a fellowship to go preach in Scotland and study at the University of Edinburgh, and they said, you must travel extensively, and we'll pay for it. So we're like, what? They go, yes, you must turn in receipts to prove that you've traveled extensively every month. So we had this incredible year over there, but what I was unprepared for was what I was about to see. University of Edinburgh, maybe 60 or 70 years prior to that time, would have been the center, at least of Reformed theology on planet Earth. This would have been, if you were thinking the great theologians, preachers, thinkers, that's where they would have been. When I got there in 1985, it was like somebody had set off a nuclear spiritual bomb. Like, what happened in one generation? What the heck happened here? How did this happen? The church I was in on Scottish standards was large. Interestingly enough, we found that they didn't even know what the word evangelism meant, because they had long given up on reaching people in the culture. You are either a church person, which was the equivalent of being in a knitting club, or you weren't. And people weren't mean about it. If you said, hey, you should come to my church, they weren't like, I don't believe that's... They were just like, yeah, I don't knit. Good luck to you. Hope that's working out, your puny little club over there, but we have no interest in it. So I left thinking, with my typical American arrogance, which I think I have even apart from America, I left thinking, like, thank goodness the church in America is not dead like this. I've come to conclude I was previews of coming attractions. I'm going to give you the statistics. Right now, the decline of the American church is a little more rapid. Even we're lagging about 20 to 30 years behind the European church. Our decline is more rapid than theirs was. And you go like, uh-oh, this is something that I go, I've seen this movie before. We're in the early stages of it, but I want you to kind of be exposed to that. Second thing I want to talk about, I lead an alternative seminary. It's called MAP. It stands for Ministry Apprenticeship Program. And it's kind of a discipleship model. I take on 10 to 30 students at a time. And basically, we spend all of our time doing ministry together. We're doing this stuff at the same time. When I first started doing that, and I would take students, at the time I was in a, what I'll call a church growth church model, where we go, let's build a big building and put on an amazing show and invite lost people to come see it. We went up and started learning from Willow Creek. Have any of you been exposed to Willow Creek? Hard not to be in the American church. Incredible stuff. I have so much respect for those leaders and their heart to really reach our culture and their willingness to sacrifice for it. Early on, I would take my students up there, and they would come back when we'd do our meltdown. You know, afterwards we go, what'd you guys get? You know what they do? Wow! When can we get a PA like that? When can we get lights like that? When can we get a food court? When can we do... That was the reaction. Somewhere, I'm going to say probably around 1995, I got a different reaction from students. When we do our meltdown, they'd go, ugh. What are you talking about? Well, it was a lot like going to Branson or Las Vegas. You know, what do you mean? In fact, I had one young guy. He was great because he's like, yeah, I got it down. I pretty much know what we need to do if we're going to reach lost people. We go like, okay, what? Glenn goes, well, they have this dance they do during worship. And I can't remember all the details, but it was like, reach to the sky, embrace the crowd, point, 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 reach to the sky.
For your heart.
That was the dance. And we're like, they don't do that. But the next session, every one of these students is watching, go, uh-huh, there it is, dance move number three. I'm like, come on. He's like, they have a class. I go, no, they do not. The point is, something shifted. I'm like, what just happened? Well, again, in my teaching stuff, I know enough to understand how much was going on in the discussion about postmodernism. Now, postmodernism is one of those terms that people use to kind of throw everything they would like to, or particularly what they don't like about the culture, into that bucket. But whatever it is, something was shifting drastically. The context was changing. And the things we used to do that might have been, you could debate that, but might have been effective, were no longer effective to the same degree. But we were struggling with that. The church I led, which was a Heartland Community Church, I planted it when I came back from Scotland. We were that kind of church. You know, we were serious about reaching lost people. How do we reach seekers was the term we used, which I now, again, go like, I'm not sure that Scripture affirms that anyone's a seeker after God. I think we are seekers, but after pleasure. I began noticing that we were really good in that model of attracting a crowd. Hey, if we got the best guitar player in town, and I was really clever in my teaching, and we showed enough video clips, and the building looked cool, and we had great parking and a coffee deal and everything, we could definitely attract a crowd. And many in that crowd, we were finding that about 25 to 30% of the people that would show up were unchurched, lost people. We're like, great, we got it. And then we discovered something. Oh, drawing a crowd is not the same thing as making disciples. I went, uh-oh. It wasn't an intent thing. And we definitely had some people who were becoming disciples. But in general, I saw that consumer model had kind of engulfed the church to the point that it kind of convinced us we were doing something, when in reality, when we looked closely at the stats, we were going like, this isn't what we were shooting at. That's not what's happening. I handed that church off to one of my students, incredible guy, doing a great job. But I began having this unintentional, what's going on, Lord? And am I too old to get on board with? Do I get what's happening here? Can I even understand that? I had a dream, and I'm not exactly a mystical guy. I don't even know what I think of all this. But I had a dream that I kind of think was from God, even though it's strange to blame God for a dream about the movie Waterboy with Adam Sandler. I'm really not sure that he does that. But anyways, I had this weird dream. You remember Waterboy? That's the Colonel Sanders professor that he tackles because he says something about his mama in there. I don't even know where this came from, but I'm in this dream. I don't remember the details, but the basic gist is somewhere in the distant future, in a seminary in America, this Colonel Sanders guy is up lecturing on church history. And his point was, I don't know, 2005 or whatever he's putting on the board, this is when we date the death of the church in America. He's going on this lecture talking about, yeah, church, they sold out to building buildings and parking lots and stuff. And then it just kind of fell off the map, and then it just kind of disappeared in North America. Now, the book, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, you know, the ghosts take him around so he gets to kind of watch. And in my dream, I think I'm kind of like with the ghost of church future or something there, and I'm watching this guy lecture, and in the dream, I shout, not on my watch, run across the room and tackle this old guy. And then I wake up. And I wake up, I'm like, should I wake my wife up? God's spoken to me, honey, through the water boy. You know? I'm just like, what was that? I have no idea what role God was in that. I think he was in it somewhere. But here's what I do know. He's right. I have this great fear that on my watch as a leader, on our watch as followers of Jesus in America, we're going to oversee something happening that we're going to go, I did not see that happening. You know, if you talk to Germans alive today during World War II, they didn't see any of that happening. They weren't like going, yeah, that we were hoping to exterminate an entire race. They were as shocked as we were. They're like, what? Well, maybe we saw clues, but we just didn't pick up on them. That's entropy. Jesus talks about it in Matthew chapter 9. He uses two analogies they would have been familiar with. No one sews a patch on some old clothes, because you understand the patch of new cloth will shrink, and it will rip the stitches, and you'll have a worse problem than you had to start with. He goes on to a second analogy. You don't pour new wine into old wineskins. Why? Well, because they all understood new wine breathes. It's like got a life. It expands. So if you put it in an old wineskin and it begins to expand, it'll burst the wineskin and the wine will run out and the wineskin will be ruined. You lose the wineskin, you lose the wine. No, you put new wine into new wineskins and both are preserved. Now, what's the context of this? In Matthew 9, Jesus is being confronted by the Pharisees, the religious leaders of his day, who say, like, how come you guys don't do it the way we do it? They're not washing their hands correctly. All the stuff we've worked out, they're not doing that. Why don't they do it that way? And Jesus tells them these stories to go like, guys, the gospel, truth, God's truth, is like new wine. It's alive. It cannot be captured in any one wineskin, ever. It will always burst them after time. Now, we know this in church history, whether we look at John Wesley and the Wesleyan Revival in Great Britain. If John Wesley were alive today, looking at what Wesleyans have done, trying to hang on to the wineskin that he did in the 1700s, they'd be like, are you kidding me? Of course that wineskin cannot hold the wine of the gospel. And yet people go, I like this old wineskin. I'm used to it. Well, we struggle with the same issue. I went out with a businessman who'd heard me talk about this stuff, and he said, hey, can I take you to lunch? I said, you paying? He said, yeah. Okay. So we go to lunch, and he says, hey, I went to Harvard Business School. I got my MBA at Harvard Business School, and you were just telling us the first case study we have to do at Harvard. I go, okay. He goes, you don't know the buggy whip case study? I go, no, don't know the buggy whip. So he gave me, I found the background. A guy named Theodore Levitt wrote this case study up. A case study is just, I'm going to write up what happened in this business and explain its decline or its growth and try and analyze the factors behind that. Well, this case study apparently is so dominated that I'm not sure that they still are, but for many years, since 1960 when it was published, they've used it as kind of an introductory case study to business. In that context, you study this company that was the most effective buggy whip company in America. Number one in sales, they dominated the market. But over the upcoming years, you begin to see their sales go into a decline. A little bit at first, and then it starts picking up. And so you get in the case study the notes from this company's board meetings where they're discussing what's going on. And their conclusions are, well, we got bad salespeople. We got to change out our sales force. Then they try to figure out, okay, we need a different leader. We need a new CEO of this company. We need vision going here. Then they try and say, we got to change our suppliers. The material we're getting is substandard. That's what's going on here. Till finally, some guy in the board goes like, okay, guys, I hate to tell you this, but there's this guy named Henry Ford. And he created this thing called the automobile. And it doesn't matter how good a buggy whip we make, sales are going to decline. Okay, the context has changed. No matter how hard you can try harder, but that's not really the issue. The issue is people aren't really looking for buggy whips. When the context changes, wineskins become obsolete. That's the principle Jesus taught that we see repeated in history and in most every other discipline. Wine skins are meant to be temporary, but the wine is eternal. And by the way, I'm going to do a quick aside here. Are some of you familiar with the term emergent church? The emergent church, this is my read on it, you certainly don't have to agree with it. I believe the emergent church, we owe a debt to them because they smelled this entropy in the church and they said, we got to do something different. We got to change the wineskin. Now, the radical elements of it decided, and while we're at it, let's tweak the wine recipe. Let's see if we can change the wine, too. I understand how they got there, but that's like the saying, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. See, Jesus was really clear. The wine of the gospel does not change. We don't have to go read our culture to figure out what the gospel is. It transcends all cultures. That's why I could go to Korea and talk with somebody that I have very little culturally in common with, but if they know Jesus and have read his word, we have amazing volumes of things in common. We have tons of overlap because the wine does not change, can't be tinkered with. But wineskins must change, and they'll change over and over again, and just when we start figuring this out, we'll go, oops, it's leaking again. And we'll have to go back. All right, so the question is, has the context changed in American culture? Again, we could talk about postmodernism, and we could explain it from that direction. I'm going to reference a book. I really don't want to glorify these guys. I don't believe they're believers. Strauss and Howe, if you're familiar with the terms like baby boomer, baby buster, Generation X, they're the guys that created those terms. Okay, their whole thing is cultural analysis from a sociological perspective. They wrote a book that when the first person handed this to me, I'm like, oh boy, here we go. Some guy's trying to be Nostradamus, tell us what's going to happen. I was unprepared for what I read. I was like, whoa, what in the world is this? They talked about the concept of the seculum. Seculum is a Roman term during the Roman Empire years. This is the term they used to talk about a generation, as the Bible calls it. About 80 to 100 year period of time was their idea of a generation. And they said the history has seculums that have four seasons to them, like our weather seasons, fall, winter, spring, and summer. And this repeats itself over and over again. Now, I'm reading this at the time, and I'm thinking, okay, well, this is some really interesting secular philosophy about the cycles of history, except I happen to be studying at the same time the book of Judges. And I start going, they didn't write this. They didn't come up with this long before the Roman Empire. The Old Testament tells us, not so much in these exact categories, but the story of the book of Judges is like a broken record that goes over and over again. The people call out to God, and he delivers them with a heroic leader, a prophet, a judge. They go into a period of high, like the Davidic kingdom, where they have enormous success, and even affluence goes up. After that, they go into another period, Strauss and Howe call an awakening, where people go, do we really need God? I think we really got here on our own. Or as Alex Haley, the writer, says, if you see a turtle on a fence post, you know he didn't get there on his own. But when a culture's in an awakening, they go, no, I'm pretty sure we got here because of our brilliant constitution and capitalism. During that awakening period, people start questioning everything. And that leads, finally, to cultural unraveling. Out of cultural unraveling, Strauss and Howe point out how through history, over and over again, there comes this thing they refer to as a fourth turning. A crisis moment that people could not see that changes everything. And that culture either rises to the occasion and moves through the crisis back into a high, or they disappear. That's why you don't know much about the Mesopotamian culture, even though it was one of the dominant cultures in human history, because they quit answering the bell. Why do you know about Egypt? Because they kept doing that over and over again. Why do you know about the Ming Dynasty in China? Why do we know about Rome? Why do we know about Europe? Well, oftentimes they made it through multiple turnings, renewed their culture, and started over again. Interestingly enough, they go through the last series we are currently, in their theory, in the fourth turning in American history. The first fourth turning was the Revolutionary War. After that, we went to a high season. After that, we went into an awakening, which even literally was we often refer to as the first great awakening, a spiritual awakening. And then we moved into an unraveling period that led us into the next fourth turning, the Civil War, about a seculum away. In the Civil War, we went through some pretty rough stuff, but eventually we came out with a cultural unity. All men are created equal. It was rough getting it. But we did come out with some of that, and it led into an unusual high period, another period of awakening we refer to as the Second Great Awakening, and then a period of unraveling again. After that, we hit one a seculum later called the Great Depression, World War II, the double whammy. An unraveling that led the flapper era of disunity into incredible unity in American culture. When the builder generation said, over there, we're going to go sacrifice everything to fight for freedom. This is what we stand for. And we rose to the occasion, according to Strauss and Howe, answered the bell in that unraveling, that fourth turning. And they would say that if that's correct, we are now currently facing another fourth turning sometime before 2050. So in their analysis, they would say, we are currently, these are not believers, they would say, we're currently in the cultural unraveling period and we're deep into it. It's unraveling rapidly. Now, I used to try and tell, you know, evidence, but I haven't found the need to anymore. I haven't had anybody that's gone like, what? I don't think our culture is unraveling. What are you talking about? They're like, yeah, I got more evidence than you got, you know. We watched TV last night, you go, some guy dressed as a Batman character goes in and shoots up a bunch of people in Colorado. You go like, well, that's always true. But there is something uniquely unraveling in American culture. In this election, remember, we just went through a couple of elections ago, an election by a hanging chad. We were that disunified as a culture. We are in that period, and Strauss and Howe would suggest nobody can tell you what it's going to be because you never see it coming. But sometime between now and 2050, we will walk through a dark corridor, a crisis that we did not see coming, and we will decide as a culture whether we will renew or not. Now, again, I'm reading this secular book going like, oh my gosh, Jesus. I was kind of getting down on next generation leaders going, they're never going to do anything. And I go, no, 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 no. You are preparing a hero generation that will either answer the bell and renew our culture or everything. We may be the United States of Iran. We might be the Republic of China. That's quite possible. By the way, they would point out different cultures go through these cycles at different times. And I have seen this. If you've been in China right now, you go like they are clearly in a cultural high. As I walked around with our students in China, it was like they will kill us at absolutely everything. Everything. They are so much better. We were playing high school student basketball. They were getting better from first half to second. We could beat them easily in the first half, not in the second half. And in fact, the first team we beat in Beijing, the students were told that they had to carry our students' bags for the next 24 hours. And our kids are like, what? No, no, you don't need to do that, man. Just come hang out. Go to dinner with us. Well, they go, no, 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 you don't understand. You have vanquished us. We must learn from you. Our kids are like, uh-oh. We are in big trouble. So again, we watch this culture in a high period, and you go like, I'm very aware we are unraveling. We don't have a whole lot that we're able to show for it. Okay, so we could spend a lot more time on that. Here's the setup. I'm really not trying to sell Strauss and Howe books here. I'm really trying to bring about the question, what's going on? Is the Western Church really in a crisis moment? Are we really unraveling? Is that what's going on? Does the evidence tell us that's true? Let me give you a little background on that. Statistical decline. 60% increase in the unchurched between 1991 and 2005. By the way, all these stats, if you want, I can give you all the background on them. I've done this enough. Even though I'm very prone, like most pastors, to over-exaggeration, I have checked these statistics and triple and quadruple checked them. So you got something, please correct me, but I'm pretty sure I'm giving you stuff that I go, there's a consensus. 60% increase in unchurched during a period that we like to refer to in the American church as the period of church growth. What? We're still calling it that. We still have schools that are going, we're teaching church growth principles. You go like, well, maybe we should be teaching church death principles, because that's what's happening. Okay, Christian Schwartz is a European, I believe he's a German, church consultant. And I like his stuff a lot. He was hired by some of the mega churches in America to do a study on their effectiveness in evangelism. So he did the study. And when they said, are you going to bring us the results? He said, you don't want to see the results. You don't have to pay me. They're probably wrong. I said, no, we want to see them. So he came back and said, I know you're going to think I put, you know, I typed an extra zero. That's not a typo. My research says that small churches in North America are 1,600% more evangelistically effective than mega churches. Here is the myth of the church growth era. I've been there. We go, hey, we got 1,000 people, and we baptized 50 new believers this year. We build a bigger parking lot, and we double the size of our auditorium. We can reach 2,000 people, and then we'll be able to baptize 100. That sounds logical, doesn't it? Unfortunately, Schwartz says, uh-uh. The larger a church gets, the less evangelistically effective they become. And they start becoming instead what he terms feeder churches. Because all the little churches in town can't compete with their amazing orchestra, rock show, amazing speaker, cool guy. And so they go out of business, and out of the 100 people that leave this little Lutheran church, 50 go over to that church, and 50 just disappear. They just go, forget it, I'm not doing this anymore. So Schwartz is telling them, guys, I know you're telling your people that if we can just build bigger buildings and get more people to come, we can be that much more effectively, but that's not. The research is stunningly opposite of that. And yet we still have churches that are operating on that. If we could just do one more satellite service, a couple more parking lots, we'll be more effective. Which is the bigger is more effective. I love it. He's a German. He calls that the y'all come model of evangelism. And that is the idea that Americans have gotten, that their job evangelistically is to invite people to services. I understand this. One of my students, a guy named Rick Francis, great guy. We were in a class, our module, we were talking about evangelism and discipleship. And so we were reading the material out there, which all says in America, you need to hang out with your neighbor more. You need to barbecue with your neighbor. Don't share the gospel with them until you spend a couple of years barbecuing, hang out with them, and then you invite them to a big, amazing event that will blow them away. They'll hear the gospel in response. Okay, so I've got these students and I'm going, okay, guys, for this whole year, I need to know, we're going to be praying for the person you're investing in. So Rick, he was totally sincere in this. He loved his neighbor. I'm not talking a project. I mean, he really loved this guy. He hung out with him. He was really working hard. I know he was praying for him. We finally get to that point. We go, Rick, you need to invite him. So Rick invites him to church. He goes, sure, yeah, I'll go to your church with you. That sounds cool. They come to church. We do our thing. Rick, on the way home, asks the guy the question, well, what'd you think? The guy goes, Rick, you guys are kicking it. That was awesome. That was unbelievable. I loved it. You're doing a great job. Rick goes, really? Wow. Okay, so you want me to pick you up for church next week? He goes, hell no. I have no interest in that. But you're doing a great job. Hey, you're almost as good as the local theater is. Rick comes back to class, he's like, well, what do we do now? We're going, maybe the wineskin's leaking. Maybe we're going to have to rethink what we're doing. Era of church growth has produced zero growth. I love Neil Cole, house church guy, talks about an organic church. It amazes me to consider how much effort and how many resources are expended for a single hour once a week. We have made church nothing more than a religious show that takes place on Sunday. Okay, that may be a little brutal because a lot of people are doing, they're not doing this with bad motives. Not all, anyways. Maybe there's some, but most of them are like, no, I think this will advance Jesus' kingdom. The question is it? And if not, what do we do about it? Okay, I'm going to talk about two crises that I think we're going through that demonstrate the decline of the Western Church. Number one, an attendance crisis. By the way, attendance certainly doesn't tell everything, but since it's what often the American church measures, we probably ought to just go ahead, well, let's see with the measuring stick we use how we're doing, because the news is real bad. The best researcher I know on this, I don't know anyone even in the ballpark with him, is David Olson. His current book is called The American Church in Crisis. Anybody read American Church in Crisis? If you're interested in this, I would say read that book. Even though it's a lot of statistics, he is a true demographer. He has a classic understanding of statistical analysis. He has double-checked his information, and he's used standard research practice to get there. Here's what he found. He, by the way, I can't remember whether he used to work for Barna or Gallup. But what he found is they used to ask the question, we've been asking this question since the early 50s, have you been to a Christian church in the last 7 days for reasons other than a wedding or a funeral? And the answer to that, since the 50s, has remained relatively constant. 40% of Americans say, yes, I have. Gone down to 38, up to 42, but it's a very narrow range. Causing a lot of people in America to go, I think we're doing fine. You know, we're holding our own. And we have a large market share. Well, Olson saw this often enough. He started seeing the statistical problems with the question. He decided to do something really strange. The people that said, yes, I've been to church in the last week, he decided, let's follow them. Let's find out if that's true or not. And he was absolutely dumbfounded at the results. He had his researchers follow a lot of these people that are taking these surveys. And he said, here's what's changed from the early 50s, we don't know how bad it was then, to now. Their willingness to lie, because half of them were lying. Why? He said, I don't totally know, but most of them, we live in an era where we take lots of surveys and we understand, I have to, you know, if I'm gay, I have to say, yes, I'm gay, and everybody else does, because we need to boost our stats up. Same thing. If I'm in the church, I need to go, oh, yes, I went to church this week because I don't want the church to look bad. But he calls that the halo factor, our propensity to lie. Here's what he found in reality. The reality of attendance in 1990 when they followed people was 20.4%, not 40%. By the time he did it again in 2000, it was 18.7. In 2004, it had dropped to 17.7. Now, he was so dumbfounded by this that he's like, I must have made a mistake here. I'm going to take this to some secular friends and say, look at my research and tell me what I did wrong. They looked at his research. They said, no, it's right, but it's hilarious. He went, what do you mean, hilarious? They go, David, you broke the first rule of statistical analysis. You know better than that. He's like, what are you talking about? They go, you forgot to curve your research according to population growth. Olson went, that's true. We never intentionally did that, but population is currently growing in that decade at 13% a decade in America. So Olson's going, so a church that says we grew 7% in actuality has only lost 6%. He said, can you imagine trying to raise money for your new building if you said to our people, hey folks, we need to raise $10 million for our new building. Things are really happening around here. We only lost 6% this decade. How different that is, it's caused this distortion in what most Americans think is going on in church. So they would go, my church is growing. Well, again, his secular friends would say, if your church is not exceeding 13%, just having kids, you're definitely not growing. So you can tell yourself that if you want, but anybody understands that if the amount of the market has changed, you're going to have to do it. Okay, so he goes back and he starts redoing his research, rethinking these things and going, what's going on? Here's what he found. There was only one population state in America that the church was growing faster than population. Only one. Here's his chart. I love it. The charts aren't supposed to be comical, but if I get it to pop up. Frozen? That's always a bad thing when it pops out. Technology is awesome when it works. Well, I'll just tell you what it says. So the next slide says that there's one Oh, I blew right past it there. Well, take my word for it. He shows all the states that are declining, that are not keeping up with population growth in blue, and those that are exceeding. There it is. He shows in pink. There's the map. One pink state. Hawaii! Even more shocking, a guy that I'm kind of familiar with, he says that it's exceeding population growth in one state due to one church. One church. Like, that's pretty cool for that church, but pretty disturbing for the rest of us. Okay, so here's what he found. Population growth. In church attendance, 1990, 51 million Americans. 2006, 51 million Americans. Here's the problem. In that same period of time, we added new population, 51 million Americans. So if you cut that off, you can go, yep, we're holding our own. If you add population in, you go, oh, we just cut the percentage of people attending church in half. Uh-oh. We've been doing some bad stats here. All right, here's his next deal. 1990, again, he found actuality 20% attend. 2018, you can see it going down. At this point, I believe he wrote that in 2009. His estimate was in 2010, it'd be 16.2. You have to check this. I'm pretty sure that in reality, since then he's put out, it actually was 14.7 or 8. So it was even more rapid than he was projecting. 2020, he was estimating 14.2, and by 2050, the current trend line statistically says the church in America will be about 10.5%. Making it the same size as the church in France. Good news, we'll still be killing Norway. We've got Norway still, but in general you go like, uh-oh. I don't think most of our people understand there's a crisis going on in the Western church. They think we got a little tiny leak, but it looks like a whole lot of wine may be spilling out on the ground. Okay, number two. First thing, sign of decline in the Western church is the attendance crisis. The second one, which in my opinion is far worse, is the church planting crisis. Here's what they found. In that period of time, in order to keep up with U.S. population growth, we needed to plant 24,000 churches. We netted 4,000. So for that decade, we fell behind at 20,000 churches that should have been planted that we didn't. and I oversee a church planting network, do you want to know what the first thing I hear from almost every Christian in America? We don't need any more churches. We got too many churches. I'm like, uh-oh, we're in trouble. The idea there is that the churches that are there because they have a building are going to be effective at reaching those new people. But what we know is that's not true. So we go, we got a problem here. Now, I will say this, and it may not be true in the city you're from, but in Kansas City, we have a hyper-suburban area of town. In our city, we might call that 135th and Metcalf. And we might have too many churches there. We might have too many church plants there. Outside of there, I remember a handful of years ago, I asked a guy in town that tracked that stuff. I said, how many urban churches have we planted in Kansas City this year? He said, one. I go, are you kidding me? One. I go, rural. We just planted in the small, we're trying to figure out how to plant rural churches. We haven't cracked that yet. It's a little town of 3,500, Garnett, Kansas. First church plant in 125 years there. You know who the enemy was at Garnett? Not lost people. The existing churches. He peed all around that territory and said, this is ours. You can't come in here. We have this market covered. You go, uh-oh, we're in trouble. We're not getting what we're going to have to do if we're going to be effective at reaching our culture. Another slide here. You don't need to spend too much time. Well, I think this is a Barna research. He's saying, here's what we know is the only churches in our culture that are reaching anyone effectively, statistically, are ones that have been planted in the last 20 years. But because of a building approach, we have all these churches. In fact, in Kansas City, it's not uncommon for me to have people who are in an older church, paid their facility long ago, going, hey, you want to do anything with our building? We're in a church currently building in a midtown area of Kansas City where there were six people left alive. And they said, we know we're all going to be dead within a couple of years. Could you guys use this? Because we put a lot into this. Could Jesus do something through you here? Because we can. Only Betty can actually walk down the street and get here. We're like, okay, we have church buildings all over America vacant. And we have young church planters who can't figure out how they could meet anyone. But the idea is, no, this is our church building. Like, no. No, it's not. It's really not. But we have a problem, and we're not really facing up to it, even though we know that church planting is still, by far, the most effective evangelistic tool possible. In the church growth church that I pastored for 18 years, we planted six other churches where we tried to raise up somebody to go do a really cool show in another part of town, and we'd send 50 to 100 people with them. And what we learned in that is, wow, when you send your best leaders in a church plant, they get hungry because they don't have cool guy stuff to attract people. So guess what they have to do? Hang out with their neighbors. Invest in their coworkers. It's like, oh yeah. I get why when we multiply, the theme of this conference, when we multiply, you cannot rely on we got a couple of super talented people and we'll just invite folks to come watch them do their thing. You have to go, oh, everybody, our phrase we would use is every disciple is a church planter. And people go, well, we'll explain later. Okay, so why are we in decline? I can't go through all the details here, but let me give you a couple. 1985 was when I came back from Scotland. The conventional wisdom in church growth circles was, here's why the unchurched do not show up. Because they believe church is boring and irrelevant. I heard this thousands of times, and I believe it's true. In 1985, they did go, yeah, it's really boring and really irrelevant. I don't have any idea what they're talking about. So what did we do? I think appropriately, we built wineskins that were exciting and met felt need. We talked about finances and parenting. Okay, and not intentionally. I think we were trying to talk about it from the Bible, but it became more and more very similar to Susie Orman on PBS talking about your finances. Because we thought that's what we got to do if we're going to reach people. And I totally get that because actually it's very effective at drawing a crowd. Again, not necessarily as effective at making disciples. Today, I'm going to suggest three different words, and you don't need to agree with me on this. These are my observations. Number one thing I think lost people in our culture today are going like, I'm not interested, is because they see church as impersonal. I will show up to your thing, and I become a giving unit. I can't tell you how many times over the years we had one of our churches, 1,400 or 1,500 people on a weekend, and I'd see people at the grocery store. I'd go, hey, what are you doing? They go, yeah, I don't go to your church anymore. Well, not my church. But, okay, tell me what happened. Well, my mom died, and nobody knew anything about me, and I didn't come for 6 or 7 weeks, and nobody missed me, so I just stopped going. What? We love you. Why didn't you call the office? And I started realizing, we become impersonal. Now, guess what discipleship is? If it's nothing else, it must be personal. We can't do discipleship in person. We can attract crowds impersonally. We can go to movie theaters and attract crowds. We can't make disciples without personal relationships. I'm going to come back to this in a second. Number two, selfish. This is the one I find more Christians are like, I don't know what you're talking about. And it may signal how out of touch we are with our neighbors. Lost people in America look at church and they go, the most selfish organization on the planet. You guys spend all your money on yourselves. And then you try and pretend you're getting a tax write-off for it. You know, okay, we're going to come back in a second and look at the evidence for that. The third thing I would say, and I don't really even need to say much about this, is that our lost neighbors look at the church and they go, I don't see any difference between you and the rest of the culture. You're hypocrites. No difference. I don't see why. All right, I'm going to show a little video here I think we have time for, because it's really funny and it's really, really painful. I'm really not showing this to try and be mean to anyone more than myself, because I've been there and I'm like, oh, Jesus, forgive us. This is a parody of kind of our current approach to church. Anybody seen this? Oh, man, this is painful. All right, if I can get YouTube to pull up here. Yeah, there it is. Turn off the lights. It's about 5 minutes, and you'll like it.
You can't stop it. Driving home my point. whole world. Whispering. Repetition. Still pausing. Same expression. Long prayer so that the worship leader can get back on stage.
Okay, even better. I had to freeze it there because I love these. Winner, Papyrus Font Award. Winner, Informally Dressed Pastor Award. Winner, Edgy T-Shirt Award. I'm like, oh God, forgive us, Lord. Again, I'm not throwing rocks. I've been there. I understand that sometimes we decided that we needed to be relevant and that's not a bad thing. That's an important thing, in fact. But sometimes the pendulum goes too far and we get to the place where we go like, okay, somehow we lost the wine in an attempt to contextualize the wine. All right, you can flip that light on there. All right, let me go through the details of those three things again, and I'm not going to spend much time because we don't have it. I would refer you, again, a secular book, Robert Putnam. Anybody had to read this, Bowling Alone? Somebody else mentioned it this week. It's not worth reading the whole thing unless you're a sociologist, but you can read the first 100 pages and really get the gist of it. He's really making one simple point. American culture has shifted where we have a lot more people bowling and a lot less bowling leagues. That's the image he uses to say what's going on in American culture. We are bowling alone. There's this deep sense of alienation. I would suggest in an unraveling culture, that's part of what you're going to get. That is to be compared with the biblical understanding of what the church is. When we read Acts chapter 2, we go like, this is anything but impersonal. Anything but. And we talk about other things in there, but that one we'd go like, no, it was definitely personal. All right, let me go on to the second one, selfishness in the church. Church Christians currently give away the same amount of money that unchurched people do in America. There is some statistical margin for error, and we could find some subgroups within the church that give a little more. I mean that, a little more. A little more. Okay, but there isn't any significant distinction there. Less than 1 in 10 evangelical tithes, even though we are the richest, most affluent culture in the history of the world, and we have a whole lot of 84% of people claim to be Christians. But we can't figure that out. U.S. church holdings, buildings, $230 billion. That's probably 2,000 or so that they measure that. And 18% of all American church giving goes to relief on the debt. It's not for buildings. This is interest on building payments. Again, this book here, I don't know if you can see that one. It's called Passing the Plate. It's written by a couple of Notre Dame guys. And I'm going to be kinder. They would say that churches in America spend between 88 and 92% on overhead. I'm going to say, let's be nice and say over 80. I'm not anti-overhead. Well, we have to keep the lights on. I'm not anti-facility. I got introduced somewhere here recently. I was speaking. They go, this is the guy that hates big churches and buildings. I'm like, okay, I'm not communicating correctly here. That's not the point. It's a proportional issue. Okay, if we continue to try and tell our culture that we're giving sacrificially, they're not seeing it. They're like, no, you're not. You're giving to yourself. I often tell the story of the speaker from Philadelphia, Tony Campolo, had a buddy that said, hey, I want you to go see, I built this new offshore oil rig, Tony. I want you to come see it. It's so cool. We got all the right technology. You got to come see it. So he goes and he tours Tony. They fly a helicopter over and they tour his oil rig and he's showing him all the cool guy stuff they have there. And Tony's like, this is really incredible. He asks the question, where's the shipping dock? They go, yeah, we don't have one of those yet. We're going to do one, but we don't have one now. He goes, well, I don't understand. How do you get the oil you produce back on shore? Well, right now, all the oil we produce is needed to run this rig. OK, Campolo gets in the helicopter, they're flying off, and he's like, I felt like God was speaking to me, going, that's the church in America, Tony. You all are telling yourself, if we could just build these buildings, if we could get bigger parking lots and hire more staff, we could reach our culture. But the stats are in. Apparently not. I told before, I think we can do this. I spent some time in an underground seminary in southwest China. I was talking with one of the students. First of all, it was a bizarre situation because Chinese pastors, if they're going to get trained, they take them to a different place in China so no one will know where they are, and they lock them in an apartment building for 3 years. They can't come out. They can't step out for 3 years. Too dangerous. So they have a box with all their stuff in it. They do everything for 3 years while they're training to learn the Bible there. So we go visit a bunch of American pastors. We go visit them, and they're having a worship service about midnight, and they whisper. The speaker whispers. They sing in whispers. Everything's in whispers. And at the end of it, they go, oh, we have these honored guests from America here, and they're telling someone special, come up and encourage us. And we're like, I don't have anything to say. You don't understand. We're not doing it this way. There's no sacrifice. When I would ask them, why are people responsive to these leaders, they go, they know how much these leaders have sacrificed for the sake of the gospel. It validates their message. When they preach, people are like, whoa, this is really expensive for this person to say these things. They go, they must really believe this stuff. So I'm talking with one of these guys, and I say, so how many paid leaders do you have per people? I don't know what you're saying. Okay, try to explain it again. Okay, how many staff people do you have for the size of a church in China, or a number of house churches, or how do you do the staffing deal? He's like, I still don't understand what you're saying. I explained to another guy, even though this guy spoke English well, I said, would you try and make a round? So he says in Chinese to the guy the question, and the guy goes, I still don't have any idea what you're talking about. So I say, okay, well, in America, we have one full-time person in ministry paid for every 100 to 150 attenders. Do you have any sense what that would be here? I don't have any idea. I said, I'm not going to hold you to it. Just give me your best shot. He says, well, let's see. I think maybe we might have one full-time leader for about every 85,000 believers. I go, okay, would you explain the question to him again? He says, well, maybe less. Maybe one to every 50,000. I go, you're not helping me. Oh my gosh, I go, they're exploding. Greater, we'll talk about it in a second, greater than any time in history. And I come back to America and my staff's going like, hey, if we could hire one more person here, I think we could really reach some junior high kids. You're like, oh my gosh. We got eight full-time youth people for, 100 kids, and they're going, we got one full-time leader for 85,000. In the midst of this, truly one of my most humiliating moments, powerful moments for me. I asked this guy, I go, well, so who's in charge? Who runs this seminary? Who teaches and stuff? He goes, well, the guy that leads all the seminaries in southwest China. I go, no, I don't think I do. You must be thinking of someone else. He goes, no, you know him. And I go, no, I don't know him. He goes, yeah, you do. So he's right there. I go, the guy that's been carrying our luggage all week? He goes, yeah. He's the greatest intellectual in China. I go, he doesn't even speak English. The guy turns around, looks at me, goes, yeah, I speak English fine. I'm like, are you kidding me? He continued doing our luggage for the rest of the week. I was so embarrassed. I'm like, dude, let me get that. It's like, no, don't blow my cover here. I left going like, oh my gosh, God, we've been telling ourselves if we had more money, we could really advance the kingdom. But the evidence is telling us that's not true. That's not what's necessary. No wonder people see the church as selfish. Okay, the last one, hypocritical. Again, I'm not going to spend much time on that. By the way, good book by Ron Sider called The Scandal of the Evangelical Conscience, in which he says, we can't find any distinctions between American Christians and non-Christians. We can't find any area where they're different, except one. I'll put this one up, because Sider was so depressed by this. He goes, we did find out that American Christians are highly more racist than non-Christians in our culture. That's the only distinction we could find. You're like, oh my gosh. So no wonder Rick's neighbor didn't want to come to church again. Because as far as he was concerned, we were no different. We were just a pale and kind of lame imitation of the culture. Paul says, don't conform to the patterns of this world, but be transformed. Basically, our cultures look at it as going like, no, you guys are completely conformed. Not us, but the outside culture is going like, we don't see any difference except your versions of our music are kind of weak. That's what we see. Other than that, not much. Impersonal, selfish, and hypocritical, and we wonder why the church is in crisis. All right, let me switch to good news. So I've been bumming you out for a while here. Here's the good news. We happen to be living at the greatest revival in the history of planet Earth. Okay, the global church is way beyond the growth of the church in the first 300 years after Pentecost. Way beyond. Okay, you can look at these stats. We can talk about them later. But what we see is on the continent of Africa, particularly sub-Saharan, China, Korea, Latin America, we can't even keep up statistically. The best statistical information is Operation World. And they are like, we can't keep putting out a new volume every year because the statistics change that much. I'll just give you one example. In Africa, in 1900, we thought there were 8 to 9 million Christians. 2000, 380 million. I just read their newest version that came out about 6 months ago, and now they're saying it's about 700 million believers in Africa. And you go like, what? Surely they've got that wrong. I go, well, cut it in half. It's still pretty stunning. China, when the communists pulled the curtain down and kicked the missionaries out, we had, we think, maybe at best, 700,000 believers in all of China. When the curtain came up, I had an incredible example of this. I was in Chicago with a man who grew up as a missionary kid. His dad was with China Inland Mission. He'd spent until he was age 50, he'd spent trying to learn Mandarin well enough that he could influence the culture, and he went with China Inland Mission into the interior of China, and the curtain closed after 6 months. He only got 6 months in China. They were kicked out. Dad came back. He said, yeah, he worked at like a hardware store. Total defeat. Like, I think I failed Jesus. I don't think I did anything. I spent my whole life preparing for this. Total failure. I was up visiting this man in Chicago in Palatine. And his father was dying that day. And he got in the mail an issue, and I'm sorry, I can't remember if it was Time or Newsweek, one of the secular magazines. The cover was The Revolution in China. And it was statistically going through the stunning explosion of the church. When the curtain came up and we went back in, we said, well, somewhere between 40 and 130 million believers all of a sudden. I was at this man's house. He was so excited. His father was dying, so excited to take him the magazine and say, look, Dad, the seeds you planted were not in vain. Look what happened. All day long, we're at his house in Chicago. Every 5 minutes, a Chinese Christian was calling his home to say, we heard your father was ill. We never met him, but we want him to know what's happened in our village because people like him were willing to plant the seeds of the gospel. This guy just sobbed all day. He just couldn't stop crying all day. And he couldn't wait to go to the hospital and tell his father about all these Chinese Christians. Never met him. Going like, but you planted the seed here. And we want you to know what happened. When the curtain came up, we were shocked. And he said, I said, did your father acknowledge? He said, the only thing he could do is kind of roll his eyes a little. It's like, I knew he knew. And it was like, Dad, we had no idea this could happen. No idea of the magnitude of what's going on there. Now, again, the Chinese, I don't want to glorify it. There are a lot of problems in these churches. But in terms of reaching their culture, they are in high and awakening periods where the church is exploding like we've never seen before. Again, we could go on more about that. A Baptist researcher, in fact, the best book I could think of for you to read as a follow-up to this class is called Church Planting Movements. Anybody read this? By David Garrison. David Garrison was basically in charge of Southern Baptist World Mission stuff. They are putting all this money and paying these people and trying to build buildings in Manila to get these Western-style churches up and running and getting almost zero results. They'd have a bunch of expatriate Americans that would go to them and a handful of Filipinos that wanted to learn English. Very little going on. And Garrison's like getting angry. He's like, we're spending all this money. We're not getting any results. So he asks these guys, what's going on here? I don't understand. Do we just need to get different people? The guy's like, well, are you asking about this church building thing we're doing? Because no, you should stop doing that. He's like, well, but we have to reach these people. He goes, oh, don't worry about that. Out the back door, these guys are planting churches like rabbits. They're multiplying so fast, we can't keep up. I don't even try to keep up with it. Garrison's like, what? You know, yeah. Well, then he began asking all over the planet when he'd visit his missions directors, and they'd all give the same story. Well, yeah, our efforts and all the money we're spending, nothing's happening. But out the back door, indigenous leaders are like multiplying like crazy. So Garrison decided, I'm getting all these world leaders together from every place I know. I'm getting them in a room. We're going to get three whiteboards. I'm going to write down on one, here's stuff every one of you do. Then we're going to have one that goes, some of you guys do this. We're going to have one that says, none of you do this. This is what he came up with. This is the board. 10 things he found that every single church planting movement he was aware of did these 10 things. Okay, now again, we have to ask ourselves, will the American church shut up and pay attention to the global church? Or will we continue to write the books and teach the conference? It's a big question. I don't want to look at them all, but I want to look at a couple. Extraordinary prayer. Again, the global leaders were saying, like, yeah, we're not at all talking about what you guys talk about when you say you're praying. So you can read it if you want to learn. Abundant gospel sowing. One of the standards for evangelism in America for a generation now has been you have to hang out with your neighbor for months and months and years and demonstrate love to them before you share the gospel with them. The global leaders go, what is wrong with you people? The power is not in the sower. The power is in the seed. It's great if the sower's a nice guy and loved on you and barbecued with you, but it's not essential. So they train their people to share the gospels abundantly with everybody. You don't have to earn the right. Because they go, no, that's the Holy Spirit's job, not my job. I go, okay, I'm still thinking about what to do with that because I have to reprogram many years of evangelism training in America where I'm supposed to hang out with my next door neighbor before I ever say anything to them. They're saying, nope, we don't do that. We just share openly and often, everybody. Next thing, leaders are not professional. Very few get paid. I worked with a church planting network where we were assessing church planters in North Carolina. Great people. Sacrificial people, but when we ask them, what do you need to go to Phoenix and plant a church? They all gave the same answer. I need $250,000, 20 acres, and a core group of 50 people. After we kept hitting, I go, is there like a book of the Bible we didn't get or something? What? Are you kidding me? You really think that you cannot advance the gospel in Phoenix without 250,000, 50 people? And 20 acres so you can put a big parking lot on. Well, these are good people. I don't know how they got there. But what we learn in the global church is leaders are not professional. I was hearing Dennis at lunch retelling the story of early Zenos days. And you know, do you remember, was it 2 or 3 years? Nobody was paid anything. It was longer than that even. And then he kind of talked about it like, yeah, we reluctantly gave up our construction stuff because construction business was in the tank under Jimmy Carter. I just thought, okay, that is normative. That's not bizarre. That's normative. See, our culture doesn't believe the gospel partially because they look at the leaders and they go, oh, I work at the post office. You're a church guy. Good for you. Go get them. I'm not that interested any more than you're interested in my designer stamps. It's your job. Okay. I go, I'm trying to train my students to go like, guys, ministry is not a career. It's a lousy career. You are called to ministry as a disciple of Jesus. Now, how you support yourself, that's a different question. And there's a lot of diversity on how that can be answered. But don't confuse those two, because the global church, if they can teach us one thing, it's like, yeah, really, if we could get rid of you paid guys, this thing might take off. And then the last thing is, this is not, this gets back to what Jim Leffel was talking about, is the micro church, cell church, house church, whatever you want to call it, is this just another way of doing church? The global leaders say, no, this is how Jesus did it. This is how the apostles did it. We follow the template. That's how you do it. Americans look at it and go, well, oh, you're doing that house church thing. Well, that's one way to skin the cat. You know, we're doing this model. Whatever model's fine. Well, because of that, I go, we have to ask this key question. Was the ministry of Jesus and the apostles a template we were supposed to follow, or is it just one of many models we could try? Now, I didn't understand this because very American. My early thinking about this was, well, you know, hey, we shouldn't be pushing this. You can do church however it works. It's very American, pragmatic. Until I read an article about baseball, and they talked about the distinction between templates and models. Template is the stuff that cannot change, kind of like the wine that Jesus talked about. Models change all the time. The template of baseball, here's the size of the field, here's how far the pitcher's mound is from home. You cannot change that stuff and still call it baseball. You can't even have a game with another team if you go, we play with two bases in Kansas City. Actually, in Kansas City, it seems like maybe we're playing with seven or eight bases there. So it's like you can't play. It's a different game. The template does not change. However, the model does. Every franchise has to figure out their style and approach to baseball. So in New York, they play baseball real different than we do in Kansas City, where we're owned by Walmart. Different approach there. It's got to be. It's just the way it is. So here's the question. Was Jesus' own example and Acts chapter 2 and 4, the pictures we get of the early church, are those just like, well, that's one way to do it? Or was he being intentional to say, guys, do it like this? Okay, this conference is about multiplication. Was Jesus' model an addition model, or was it a multiplication? I would say multiplication is the template. Now, in every city and every place and every population, working with junior high kids is going to look really, really different. The model will. But the template of multiplication will remain the same. That does not change. Well, that's going to be tough for us to go separate the wineskin from the wine. Here's our observations. I got a couple more things, and then we'll be done. I think we're supposed to be done at 3:15, right? Okay. I'll try again. My shorthand for Acts chapter 2 is we've been studying it. We're trying to train ourselves and our leaders. We notice a couple things. There's two locales mentioned. They met in the temple courts. Now, by the way, when I talk to Americans about this, you know what they do? They go, see, they met in the temple courts. They built themselves a big building, and all the believers met at 10 o'clock on Sunday mornings in the temple. It's like, no, no. When it says they met in the temple courts, actually it says in Solomon's colonnade. I was there not long ago. I've actually seen it. You know what it is? The equivalent today would be they met in the local park and proclaimed the gospel openly in front of all the people. It's like, oh, okay. But the point is, they did have large group meetings. That's okay. But they met in each other's homes. Now, here's what we talk about. Oftentimes, the church growth model of church has said the cake is the show on Sunday. The icing is small group. If you're really committed and you really want to, like, really get involved, then you should get in a small group. We're going, no, the biblical template is the opposite. Jesus did proclaim the gospel openly to crowds and then usually tried to offend them all and scatter them. In fact, there's only one time when somebody goes, Jesus, this is awesome that we're here. I'm going to build a really cool building and everyone will come listen to you. It's the Mount of Transfiguration when Peter tries to convince Jesus to do the first building program. He's like, no, Peter, get behind me. No, we're not doing that. Okay, we go. The other thing we notice in Acts 2 is they're devoted, the word devoted, to three things. Actually, the text can look like four, even though one of them in Greek is more of a slash. They were devoted to the apostles' teaching, not to reading blue like jazz, the apostles' teaching. Second of all, they were devoted to the fellowship through the breaking of bread. Some people separate that out. I'm okay with that. And they were devoted to prayer. The result of that, we call it the seven fruits. Here's seven descriptions of what happened because they devoted themselves to those three things in the temple courts and house to house. So I go, look, that's template. Now how that looks and how you do it and how often, I'm like, whatever, let's figure that out together. But let's stop arguing the template. Now here's how I would describe it in shorthand. Again, forgive me for my acronyms here, but I'm trying to describe. The model of church the West has been doing is what I call BCS. You get the association there? Yeah. BCS sounds evil already. By that I mean most people in the West believe that church is a building with a celebrity CEO that puts on a show on Sunday. Now there's nothing wrong with any of those things, but I want to point out none of them are mentioned by Jesus or the apostles. None. Not even mentioned. We don't even have a building that we can find architectural evidence for until 320. That was some guy who expanded his living room so he could get more people in. That's the closest we get to a church building for the first 300 years. Building, celebrity CEO show on Sunday. Not bad things, not biblical things, not the template. So what is the template? I would say, again, this conference we're talking about mostly disciples, not just Christians, disciples, on mission, not just going, entertain me, feed me, but pointed outward with Jesus. Okay? Let me talk about the two changes that have to occur, and I have 30 seconds to do that. So, okay? Two things I would say. Number one, this is the big insight we have found. When we've particularly been working with students, we found if we teach them how to share their faith by saying, ask that person if they've ever received Jesus, 84% of people will say, yep, done it, three or four times. Young Life Club, did it last week. Did it. It's like, you go, okay, I guess we're done. There are 16% who are hardcore pagans, probably not the kind you want to share that stuff with. It would take a little longer than a quick conversation. What we have found, again, Barna points out 66% of those are what he calls casual Christians. We call them non-disciples. We try and not let people go, oh, we need to reach non-Christians. We go, no, not in our culture. That's a meaningless term now. We need to reach non-disciples. By the way, the word Christian is only used a couple of times in the New Testament. One of them's pejorative. Okay? Jesus did not, at the end of his talks, go, all of you who would like to receive me, raise your hand. This is a 20th century Western phenomenon. What did Jesus say? Drop your nets. Come follow me. Be my disciple. So the first thing we've concluded, if we're going to get back to a biblical template of church, is we have to start asking people, are you a disciple? I never thought I'd be in the track writing business, but this is one of our guys who's kind of developed this, and I've worked with him on. We have a deal where we get students now, we're trying to get everybody to go like, okay, receiving a salvation is really essentially important. You can't enter the kingdom of God unless you're born again. But 84% of Americans go, yeah, I've totally done that. Yep, no question about it. But when we ask them these other questions, are you enlisted in his body? Do you abide in his presence daily? Are you contributing with your time and your money to his cause? And the last one, even more important for postmoderns, do you heed his commands? Or are you sleeping with your girlfriend? They often say, well, I'm not really a disciple. I'm a Christian, but I'm not really a disciple. We have shifted our approach to going, do you want to be a disciple? We have found a whole lot of people go, yeah, I do. And you go, okay, you want to start reading the Bible to see what Jesus has to say about being a disciple? We can start working on this together. But we've stopped trying to ask, are you a Christian? And instead, we've started asking, are you a disciple? We think that shift in questions is critically important. And then the second is what we've been talking about all this week. We need to shift from an attractional model, come in here, to a missional or a multiplication model that says go and tell. Okay, I'm going to pray, and then I'm sorry we're 3 minutes over here, but I'll pray, and then you can stick around. I'll answer whatever questions you want. Again, if you're interested in this information there, email me there, and we'll try and get it back to you. But let's pray. Jesus, I'm envious. I'm just so upset that the church is exploding globally, but not here. I don't want that to be true, Jesus. I know you don't want that to be true. I know it's not reluctance on your part. You're not waiting to send your Holy Spirit. You're waiting if you will find faith. Jesus, give us as a generation faith in our culture. Help us rely on your Holy Spirit in such a way that you can blow new wind into the sails of the church in America. I do not want to be a leader, Jesus, in the period when we let go. I want to be in a period where we begin to retake territory. And we ask for that in your powerful name. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.